Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Yes, LBJ, Dignity of Man. Hey, 2015 marks the 80th anniversary of the Social Security Act, and it remains one of the most popular federal programs with all political and social demographic groups supporting it. Yet in recent years, mostly, though not entirely, Republican politicians have tried again and again and again to raise fear that it isn't working and ought to be replaced with a private system subjecting the insurance funds to the vicissitudes of Wall Street. Well, there's a brand new book out about it called Social Security Works, Why Social Security Isn't Going Broke and How Expanding It Will Help Us All. And one of the co-authors is Nancy Altman, who has a 35-year background in the areas of Social Security and private pensions. She's co-director of Social Security Works and co-chair of the Strengthen Social Security Coalition and Campaign. She's the author of The Battle for Social Security, From FDR's Vision to Bush's Gamble. And from 1983 to 89, Ms. Altman was on the faculty of Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, taught courses on private pensions and Social Security at the Harvard Law School. In 1982, she was Alan Greenspan's assistant in his position as chairman of the bipartisan commission that developed the 1983 Social Security amendments. She's currently board chair of the Pension Rights Center and lives in Bethesda, Maryland. And again, she's co-author with Eric Kingston of the just published Social Security Works, Why Social Security Isn't Going Broke and How Expanding It Will Help Us All. Here's what Bernie Sanders had to say about the book. Social Security Works puts expanding Social Security front and center on the national agenda, where it belongs. Everyone who has a stake in the debate, and that's everyone, should read this important book. The book makes the case that Social Security is the program that can help stop the collapse of the middle class, lessen the pressure squeezing families from all directions, and help end the upward redistribution of wealth that has resulted in perilous levels of inequality. The book explains that not only can we afford to increase Social Security benefits, we can't afford not to. Well, thanks very much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive. Nancy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what exactly is Social Security? How and why and when did it come about? What was life like for old people, orphans, and widows before Social Security? How did it come about and when?
Well, you were right when you introduced it. It has stood the test of time. 2015 is the 80th anniversary of its enactment. It was enacted as part of the Social Security Act of 1935. It really transformed our nation. At the time Social Security was enacted, every state but New Mexico had poorhouses. And those were tended to be populated by older people, people who had been independent wage earners their whole life. But then as they grew older, they lost jobs, couldn't find new employment, and generally moved in with their children. But if they didn't have children who could take them in, they literally wound up in the poorhouse.
Hmm.
That is something, thank goodness, that is part of our past. What Social Security does, the genius of President Roosevelt, who championed this program, is that he understood that in our kind of society where people are dependent on salaries and wage income, that we all need insurance against the loss of those wages. We need unemployed, we need unemployment insurance. We need, if we become die leaving young children, we need life insurance. If we become disabled, we need long-term insurance. And we also need annuities, old-age annuities that we cannot outlive. Mm-hmm. Now, the unemployment insurance was part of the Social Security Act of 1935. It's not what we generally call Social Security. But the last three risks, Social Security is wage insurance against the loss in the event of death, leaving dependents, long-term disability, and old age.
And it in this new book, Social Security Works, you point out that Social Security has never contributed a penny to the national debt. You know, the Republicans and probably some Democrats are, you know, it seems like trying to confuse people. And, you know, if they talk about the national debt, oh, we have to do something about the national debt. And sometimes they look to cutting Social Security. You also say it is virtually impossible for Social Security to go bankrupt. So it doesn't contribute a penny to the national debt, and it's virtually impossible to go bankrupt. How do you reach those conclusions?
Well, Social Security is completely self-financing. It is its primary source of revenue is from insurance contributions or premiums paid by workers and then matched dollar for dollar by employers. And it has no borrowing authority, and by law, it cannot pay benefits unless it has sufficient income to cover the cost. So is there is no way that it can contribute to the deficit because it can't borrow. It, in fact, is a creditor of the United States. Currently, Treasury has issued Treasury obligations in the order of about $18 trillion. $2.8 trillion of that is owed to Social Security. Social Security, whenever it has a surplus, it invests by law in Congress requires that it be invested in the safest investment on earth, which is U.S. Treasury bonds backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. And it currently has a surplus of $2.8 trillion and growing. So there is no way that it can contribute to the deficit or the debt. And in addition, it really doesn't make sense to talk about it going broke. Mm-hmm. But one thing, it is under pension jargon called current funded, which it means that its income comes from the deductions from workers' wages matched by employers. That's the primary part. As long as Americans are working, that income is going to be flowing into Social Security. So there will always be enough to pay the bulk of the benefits. And in fact, even the most current projections show that Social Security can pay full benefits without a problem for about the next almost two decades. And after that, if Congress were to do nothing whatsoever, it would forever be able to pay about three-quarters of scheduled benefits. Now, that's obviously not good enough, and we want it to be able to pay 100%. But the idea that a lot of young people think it won't be there for them, that would take an act of Congress. They would have to repeal Social Security.
So it's going to be there for young people these days. I mean, because people are concerned. There's this quick image that young people are contributing to a lot of us baby boomers, quite frankly, and that their money can't fund it all.
That's right. I mean, the important thing for younger people to understand, in fact, for all of us to understand, is that even if you're not claiming benefits at this moment, you are insured against these various risks. And of course, none of us like to think that we're going to walk outside our door and get hit by a truck, or that we're going to go to the doctor and find out that we have cancer, or some horrible fate. But unfortunately, that does happen in life. And all of us, all workers, are insured that if that happens and they lose their wages, Social Security is there for them. So it's not that you have to wait for some far-off distant point when you reach old age. It's there for you right now. But it also will be there, let's hope, in most people, and we all want to reach old age,
yes.
not have one of those horrible things happen beforehand. And it is there for us then. And one thing that's important to understand is that it's not an accident or somehow being missing, you know, just kind of not following the news or something that people think it won't be there. The younger you are, the less likely you are to think it won't be there. As we discuss in our book, there has been a campaign to undermine confidence in the future of Social Security.
Oh, has there.
And that campaign has worked in this very mm-hmm. way, that you ask a group of young people, and most of them have heard and don't believe, and as a consequence, believe that Social Security won't be there for them.
Mm. And it's so untrue, but fear, hey, let's face it, fear is a brilliant political strategy. It works. You know, people buy into fear, and it's very effective. You look around, I mean, and FDR was a brilliant president, and one of the things he said, of course, about the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. He knew how powerful fear was, and we've seen fear at work. We're talking on Keeping Democracy Alive with Nancy Altman, co-author of the new book, Social Security Works. And, you know, 80 years is a long time. Things have changed. One of the factors, I believe, at the time of the creation of Social Security back in 1935 was the fact that in terms of age benefits, no one got money until he or she was 65. Now, back then, not a lot of people lived much past age 65. I understand the average male life at the time, average male life expectancy was 57. Now, that factors in a lot of childhood deaths as well, which, you know, it has changed radically. A lot of people are living way past 65. My impression is that the anti-Social Security politicians have fanned the flames of those fears that the massive number of us baby boomers, 10,000 boomers, will turn 65 every day between now and 2030, there will be a drain on the system. How can fewer young workers possibly support a greater number of retirees? So you're saying,
well,
go ahead.
I'm so glad you asked that, because actually implicit in your question was one of the fear tactics of the other side.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that that as you said in your question, our life expectancies have grown, but they haven't
yes.
grown as substantially as everyone, as a lot of the other side tries to portray. If you look at life expectancy from birth, you do have these big changes, but that's because a lot of people died in childhood.
Yes.
We didn't have all the antibiotics and immunizations yes. and so forth that we have today. So you had a much higher rate of childhood mortality.
Yeah.
If children reached age 21, they generally reached age 65. So for the period of time they were insured under Social Security, they were living to 65. And if you look at life expectancy from 65, because that's when you have to pay out these benefits,
mm-hmm.
there has been an increase, but it's been more about 5 years or 6 years.
Oh, really?
Now, that's significant,
yeah.
but it's not. You know, people who live to 65 used to live to 77 or 78. Now they might live to 82 or 83. Now, that is an increased amount, which we should be
factoring in,
very
yeah.
pleased about. It's a success story, not not a problem or not something to be worried about. But the point is that some of the fear is, oh, nobody even lived to 65. Well, of course they did. That's why we had this retirement program. So that's the first point to understand. The other is that under current law, the Social Security retirement age is already going from 65 to 67.
Yeah.
It's slowly being phased in. For those born after 1959, the retirement age will be 67. So that's already a two-year change, which is a complicated concept, but it actually is a benefit cut. It's moving us really in the wrong direction.
Mm.
The basic point is that we are the wealthiest country in the world at the wealthiest moment in the history of humans. We are wealthier now than we were in 1935 when Social Security was enacted. We are much wealthier than we were in 1939 when survivors' benefits were added. We are much wealthier than we were in 1956 when disability benefits were added. And we're much wealthier than we were in the early 1970s when there were automatic annual cost of living adjustments. There is no question we can afford Social Security. We are more productive and wealthier now. So it's not a matter of demographics or mathematics. It's a matter of what we want to do as a society. And our polling shows that when put to the choice, do you want Social Security cut? Do you want to keep it the way it is? Do you want it expanded? People say they want it expanded, and that is the right policy as well.
Expanding Social Security. And there's an issue that's getting more and more attention these days, and that's about the lifting the cap. And there's a much more attention being focused on that. And that is basically only the first 118,500, I think, of a person's income pays Social Security. So after $118,500, any income on top of that doesn't pay Social Security. Now, the noise that's happening these days is people wanting it to change, to lift that cap. Tell us, if you would, about what all the hubbub is about and your thoughts on this issue.
Yes. Now, the important thing to remember about Social Security is that as important as the financing is and ensuring that benefits can be paid over the long run, and there's a lot of care given to that, that's a means to an end. The end is, what kind of economic security do we want to provide for ourselves and our families? And then what is the fairest way to fund that? Currently, we have benefits that are extremely modest. Yes. And when we talk about expand, we talk about increasing the basic level of benefits, which on average is only about $15,000 for retirees, around the amount of full-time minimum wage work. And that's average.
Yeah, for a year, yeah.
So the benefits are quite modest by virtually any standard. But we also mean expanding the kinds of benefits. Social Security is a very flexible institution and very adaptable. And there is workers currently have, thanks to the federal government, have guaranteed family leave, but not paid family leave. It should be paid. We're the only country that doesn't have paid family leave. Every worker should have paid sick leave. Those are benefits that can be provided through Social Security, and we think should be. Then the next question is, well, what's the fairest way to pay for these, to pay for the current level of benefits and the increases? And we have a number of proposals in our book, but one that has caught on that a lot of people are talking about is the one that you just discussed. We currently have a system where someone making $118,500 pays 6.2% of their wages toward Social Security, and they pay all year. If they've got a steady job, that comes out of every single paycheck and gets paid in. But once you hit that $118,500, you stop paying in. So someone making twice that amount would only be paying 3.1% of their total wage income in, and would stop after about 6 months. If you're Bill Gates, you probably stop by the time on January 1, by the time you have lunch, because you make so much money.
True.
So the one way of bringing new revenue into Social Security that a lot of people think is quite fair is to make sure that all of us pay the same rate and all of us have the withholding all year long. So that's a proposal. But there are a number of other proposals as well, all of which are both fair, spread the cost without unduly burdening anyone, and as a side benefit, begins to reduce some of this, really what we call upward redistribution of wealth. Mm-hmm. So much of the productivity gains of the last, in fact, virtually all of the productivity gains of the last 20 or 30 years has gone to those at the top 1%. And it's really not good for our society, not healthy for us, and not fair.
And it's not just a question of morals and ethics. It's economically kind of dumb to have all that money going to the top 1% or even the top 0.1%. It just is not good for our economic national security. So I wonder if there are figures, if people, I mean, because there are people who make a heck of a lot more than $118,500 a year. I wonder how much more money might be there for the Social Security Trust Fund if if the cap were lifted. I'm not sure specifically if there'd be any cap or you know, what kind of figures are being talked about, how much more secure that would make the Social Security Trust Fund.
Well, there actually are a number of proposals, and they've all been costed out by the Social Security Administration. There's an Office of Actuaries, 40 actuaries or so, who make these calculations. Uh-huh. And so there are various proposals. Some are to phase in an elimination completely. Some put a new cap at, say, $250,000, not sort of a donut hole. It's where you've got those making over $250,000 pay more, and because not to burden someone who's just making $120,000 or $125,000, those proposals. Some have it at $400,000 and so forth. There are various ways that it can be structured, but it's an enormous amount. For example, just as the most modest proposal, Congress put that cap at a place where they intended that 90% of all earnings in the nation were covered.
Uh-huh.
But because we've had so much income inequality, that 90% has dropped to about 82%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's billions and billions of dollars each year. A modest proposal, which is simply require everyone to pay at most one additional week of withholding and gradually restore over about 30 years, get us back to 90%, would eliminate one-third of the current shortfall. So you can see there's an enormous amount of money there. But we would go further. We think that is fair and right, but that just is proportionate. And we believe that who have benefited so much from our commonwealth and our being a part of this great nation, that we should have some progressivity. There was some that was introduced and some reforms in 1983. Now, again, most of Social Security's revenue has always come and will always come without dramatic change from workers' contributions matched by their employers, and that's how it should be. And that's how we think it should be and how it will remain. But, for example, we in our book propose that people who have total income, not just salary income, but capital gains, other kind of income, and make over $1 million in a single year, that their million and first dollar be taxed an additional 10 cents. So they'd still get to keep the rest of it, and if they're making $100 million, it's all above $1 million. And if they're making $1 billion, bless them. But the 10% of that would go to Social Security. So, and that's money made in a single year. That's not just total wealth.
Right.
So others have proposed dedicating an estate tax to Social Security. Others have talked about financial transaction tax. There are a number of ways to bring in more revenue for Social Security, still keeping it as an insurance program with earned benefits, but allowing us to raise benefits for all of us.
And to keep it even more secure for the long term, as intended. And you know, these changes, 80 years, a lot happens. And as you mentioned, the $118,500 at one point covered 90% of Americans. And now, you know, there are some, just a very few, who make incredibly more than that. We're talking on Keeping Democracy Alive with Nancy Altman, co-author of the brand new book, Social Security Works, Why Social Security Isn't Going Broke and How Expanding It Will Help Us All. And Talking Points Memo has an article out today. They say the program is currently projected to start running out of money in 2033. And before you address that, Bernie Sanders said, quote, if Republicans are serious about extending the solvency of Social Security beyond 2033, I hope they will join me in scrapping the cap that allows multimillionaires to pay a much smaller percentage of their income into Social Security than the middle class. Now, the Republican reaction, and a Republican aide to a senator said, we do not support increasing taxes on the American people, when asked about that. Comments on that, please, Ms. Altman.
Well, first of all, the contributions to Social Security are premiums. People receive benefits from that. So it's a little different from taxes. But the main point is that this is, again, politics in the best sense of the word, how we as a society want to divide our commonwealth. And poll after poll after poll shows that, first of all, most Americans don't even realize there is a cap, because 94% of Americans don't make $118,500 or more. It's only 6% of the American public that does. But when they find out, they have this general sense, because we're not talking about a progressive payment. We're talking about proportionate, that everybody pays the same rate.
Mm-hmm.
So it strikes people as fundamentally fair and is something that really cuts across all kinds of demographic lines and political lines. There are conservatives as well as liberals who think that this concept makes sense. But as I say, this is just one of a number of proposals and could be put together in a package of revenue increases, which we propose. Again, because the goal is to provide this basic economic security, and we believe, and we see that polling shows others agree with us, that we should be expanding Social Security. Every generation has improved it and left it better than it was before, and now it's our turn, and we should be increasing these modest but very vital benefits.
I got to ask you, my parents were economically comfortable, and they felt funny about receiving Social Security checks. What about the idea of a means test? Would that save a lot of money? What are your thoughts on this perennial proposal?
Not only would it not save really any money at all, unless the means tests were put quite low, you know, $50,000 or something that really would hit the middle class. But it would really destroy the program. It would fundamentally change it. Because when you put in a means test, means tested programs are fine. We will always, unfortunately, probably have the poor among us. And when people are poor, we really should be giving a helping hand and assisting. But those programs tend to be structured that you want to make sure the people are really deserving and they really have the don't have the means. And it becomes very complicated. You've got to check and see because income fluctuates and so forth. The beauty of Social Security is it's earned. It is not a government handout. There's common language these days of calling it an entitlement. It is not an entitlement in the sense that it's a giveaway or a government handout or something. It's something we all, President Roosevelt called it using the government as an instrumentality, where we all get together and we contribute. And the beauty of Social Security's insurance, unlike private insurance, is that we're not paying high salaries to CEOs and paying civil servants. We don't have to do a lot of advertising because it's it has as wide a risk pool as you could have, so it's very efficient. Social Security spends less than a penny of every dollar on administrative costs. You can't find that in the private sector. So it's an insurance program, and I'm sorry to hear that your parents didn't felt funny about it, and some of that is this campaign that's been going on to undermine people's confidence and to make people think it's not going to be there, and they shouldn't take more than, you know, they shouldn't take theirs if they don't really need it. The point is, if your house burns down, if Bill Gates has fire insurance and his house burns down, nobody says, oh, but he doesn't need it, let him just rebuild. He paid for his insurance. He gets the proceeds. And the same thing is true with Social Security.
Oh, interesting. Good point. And Social Security's detractors have argued that people could receive bigger checks were their money invested individually on the stock market. Some people call Social Security forced savings. What's a better way to think about that? What kind of uncertainties? You've gone over a bunch of them that require insurance as a solution. Why not self-insure against life's up and down? Why not put the money on the stock market?
Well, there's a big difference between savings and insurance. If, again, to use the fire, when you're when you own a house, you don't put a you don't have a savings account in case the house burns down. You have fire insurance because there are certain kinds of risks. They make the risks that are unlikely but devastating, such as you know a fire in your home, but or permanent and serious disability or dying, leaving young children. But if it happens, it's devastating. So life insurance and disability insurance are two benefits that Social Security provides. But in addition, when there is something that is you can predict for the group but not for an individual, you also need insurance. So, for example, if my children who are in their 20s were to ask me how much should I save for retirement, I would say, well, let me ask you, when do you plan to die? Because if you're going to die at 57, you don't need to save a penny. But if you're going to die to 100, if you're going to live to 102, you're going to need to save a lot. And at what age are you going to retire? And what will you be earning then? All kinds of questions that don't lend themselves to a savings model. That is what we need insurance for. The beauty of Social Security and the beauty of joint survivor annuities, which is what Social Security provides, is that you can outlive your savings. You cannot outlive Social Security. Oh, wow. It's guaranteed. So it is wrong to talk about, well, I could get more in the stock market. Well, maybe you start to invest in the stock market and you have a devastating accident. Well, what are you going to do then? I mean, that's your savings are not going to help you then. You need that kind of insurance. And as I say, you can. What if when you it's time for you to retire, you have the Great Recession? It was 2007 right. or 2008. Yeah. Well, your 401k, many people lost an enormous amount
yes.
in that. You either have to keep working or live on much less. That's why you need this kind of guaranteed benefit. Not that savings aren't important. Everyone should save.
Yes.
But what you need for this fundamental basic economic protection is insurance, not savings. It's actually an old saw. As you mentioned, my first book, The Battle for Social Security, which is a history. And Alf Landon in the election of 1936 talked about it as forced savings. It's a way of undermining support for the program. The difference is each of us can save on our own. We don't need anyone telling us to save. But unless you're Bill Gates or someone of that kind of wealth, you can't self-insure. None of us have those kinds of resources. That's why we all pool our funds as we do in Social Security and as we do in most other insurance. Some have called Social Security the purest form of insurance because, as I say, there is not money taken out for CEOs and for advertising, and there's no savings component to it. It is pure insurance.
And how, as compared to Wall Street, you know, gambling on Wall Street, which sometimes pays off and sometimes doesn't, for sure, and the CEOs get paid, you know, a tremendous amount of money, how... What kind of bureaucracy is there managing the investments for the Social Security funds?
Well, there is the money is just like with any other pension trust. The money is kept in trust on behalf of the American people, and there is a board of trustees who are responsible for the investments. Now, Congress has made it very easy because they've required that the money be invested in government obligations backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. So there's not a lot of discretion
lot of
in what
room, yeah.
you can invest in. But let me add that another way, now this, a lot of people get confused about this and some people don't like this idea. But one of the things we talk about, another way to bring in more revenue into Social Security, along with scrapping the cap and the millionaire's tax and other kinds of things, is to diversify the portfolio. I mean, every financial advisor talks about investing in stocks and bonds, and you could have Social Security invest part of its surplus in very safe, broad-based, indexed funds. That way, you'd get all of us would get the return of equities, which tend to grow faster than bonds. But the difference is that Social Security is there for the duration, so there's no limited time horizon. You don't have to sell in 2008 the way an individual might. And the ups and downs aren't concentrated on an individual as they are with individual savings, mm-hmm. but are spread across all of us. So that actually itself is a way to bring in that, if only if that were done, that would also make bring in significant additional revenue over time. But as I say, it's something that should be debated. It's controversial, and people are not all that comfortable with it. But it is an option if what people want is the greater return you get in the market with really minimal risk, because it's all of us together, and the benefit themselves would remain guaranteed. Right now, if you have an individual account, it depends what's in the account at the time you retire, what your benefit will be. But with so-called traditional pensions, which are unfortunately disappearing from the private sector, and Social Security, the benefit is guaranteed. The financing could be invested in this a slightly more aggressive way.
Slightly more aggressive tends to make more, but that's not security. You know, there's some degree of risk there, and it sounds like
that's right. And that's the question, and that's really a question for the American people. It's completely unnecessary. We are the wealthiest nation in the world, as I say, and we've got, doesn't always feel that way to everyone because wages have stagnated so much for the middle class. But there's no question we can afford Social Security without that kind of risky investment. But, for example, Canada has decided that it will invest its Social Security that way and has had no problem with that and does get a slightly higher return. So it's not, and a number of states do that, and the Federal Reserve Board does that. So there are public plans that do it. It's a question of whether we want that for Social Security or not. And quite frankly, my attitude is that what we don't want to do is cut benefits. We don't want to means-test Social Security. We don't want to convert it to private accounts. We don't want to radically transform it. We want to bring in more revenue. But it seems to me if we could agree on that, we could, I think, easily agree on how we spread the risk and how we spread the cost in a way that seems fair to the large majority of us.
And unquestionably, one of the reasons Social Security is so widely beloved, and it really is beloved, that's not too strong a word to use, is because Social Security is doing what it was designed to do. Those Social Security checks help retirees stay afloat, if just barely. But in what ways, I wonder, does Social Security boost the entire economy and strengthen our communities and families? And what do you mean when you write, the America we know today would not be possible without Social Security?
Yes. I mean, it really is one pollster told us that the feelings about Social Security are so deep that they really represent a value, not just a preference. And I think the reason is the American people we're a pragmatic group, and we recognize that we like the entrepreneurial spirit. We want people to take risks, but we want a floor of protection underneath us, so that there's something that is a foundation that we won't fall below. And that's what Social Security does. It encourages people to take risks because they don't have to worry about, is my employer providing a 401k or something like that, because they've got this. Now, it's not big enough right now, but an expanded Social Security would do this more, so that it provides this basic economic security. Before Social Security was enacted, there weren't nationwide statistics, but the best statistics that are available showed that about one out of two people, and when they reached age 65, had incomes below subsistence. They were underwater, and they either, as I said, wound up moving in with relatives or living in a poorhouse, but unable to remain independent. That has been transformed. Although a very fine nonpartisan organization, a think tank, has found that without Social Security, we would again have almost 48%, almost one out of two seniors with income below the subsistence level. So we've come a long way, but it's because of Social Security. Some people think, oh, we don't need it anymore. Look how well everyone's doing. Well, it's because of Social Security. Mm. And as you point out, it also is incredibly important for our economy. Social Security is pays very modest benefits, and the people who receive them tend to be a very, very modest income.
Yes.
And tend to use that money spent right away in their communities. So Social Security is very important in rural areas. Particularly, it's important all through the nation, but it's often very important in rural areas. It's often very important in low-income urban areas and so forth, because the money is keeping business in those communities going. It's also important in this last recession. Well, let me go back. In the Great Depression in the 1930s, there was huge levels of unemployment, but hidden in the shadows of the unemployment figures were children who of working people who also had lost that support, but also aging parents who were living with those adult children. So it was three generations that suffered when a worker became unemployed. This time, with the Great Recession, you still had too many workers who lost their jobs, and their children were hurt, but their adult parents continued to receive Social Security, their aging parents, and often supported the rest of the family and helped the children and the grandchildren. And that's a key. There are so many ways that Social Security is important, but it's not just the economics, as important as that is. It's the values that underlie the program, the idea that it's supposed to be providing all of us with a sense of security and peace of mind, which unfortunately has been lost because of this misinformation that it's going bankrupt and so forth. But it really reflects basic American values, and which is why it is so important.
We are talking on Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen. Our guest today is Nancy Altman, whose brand new book, along with Eric Kingston, is Social Security Works, with an exclamation point, Why Social Security Isn't Going Broke and How Expanding It Will Help Us All. And I do want to get to the expansion idea, but in what ways is Social Security a partial corrective to the racial wealth gap? I wonder about that. And following up on that, critics say it's socialism. And a key component of that philosophy is redistribution of wealth. Talk about that, if you would, please, the racial wealth gap. And, you know, is it socialism, a redistribution of wealth?
You know, again, Social Security is so important. It's really important to everyone, but it is particularly important to people of color. It's particularly important to unmarried women, whether they're divorced or widowed or never married. It's particularly important to members of the LGBT community, to people who've been disadvantaged in the workplace. It both is often the only retirement income that they have, but it also is, because of its clever design, provides proportionately larger benefits to lower-income people, to people who've been unemployed and out of the workforce and so forth. And sometimes people, you know, the opponents call it socialism and so forth, but again, it's the idea of insurance. All of insurance is redistributive. I mean, if you and I have fire insurance, same fire insurance, and my house burns down, but yours doesn't. Well, I'm getting some of your premiums. You know, your money is coming to me. There is a kind of redistribution, but that's, as I say, all insurance. That's the concept of it, that we're all paying in a small amount to insure ourselves, and then whoever suffers the event draws out. So one of the clever parts of Social Security, it's sometimes called social insurance, is that it wants to be and is fair in the benefits it provides, so that the more you contribute, the larger your benefit. But it also recognizes that people who've been lower income their whole lives, or you might start out higher income, but you become disabled and you don't, or you become unemployed and you don't work, you know. So over your work life, if you've wound up being on the lower end of the income scale, in recognition that those people have had less discretionary income and then couldn't save and have greater expenses related to their income, necessities, Social Security provides a greater proportionate benefit. So mm-hmm. it's a little bit complicated to get at first, but it's sure. very clever. It provides absolute larger dollar amount to those who contribute more, but it provides proportionately sure. bigger benefit return to those who contribute less. And that's the way it combines this fairness to everyone, sure. but particularly making up for disadvantages or discrimination in the workplace and in greater society.
You know, it's amazing how Republicans in the past, I'm thinking of Eisenhower, would talk about anybody who talks about dismantling or changing Social Security is basically nuts. And yes. and nowadays, there are people who are actually saying that, and they tend to be Republican. What interests are generating these fears of insolvency in Social Security? What is their real agenda? Who is funding these efforts?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. And let me say that, as I said, I've written this history of Social Security, the battle for Social Security, and in it, there've always been, in every generation, there've been a small group. President Eisenhower called them a small splinter group of, fringe who really thought Social Security socialism, or it shouldn't, no. government shouldn't do it, or whatever the argument is, which is they can hold that position, but they are a minority, and most people disagree with them. But then, starting in the late 1970s, the tactic appears to have changed. Either they all died out, which is hard to believe, or they started saying, well, we've lost every time, because every generation, as you said, Eisenhower said the same thing. If you frontally attacked it as this is a bad idea, they would lose, because the American people would say, we disagree. So they started saying, oh, it's a wonderful idea, but we can't afford it. We're going bankrupt. And as I said, if you just stop for a second, we are so much wealthier now than we were ever before in our history. And yet there is this, these sound bites, everyone's growing. We've got an aging population. People are living so much longer, all of these kinds of things, that it sounds, on the surface, it sounds correct, and it gets people very uncomfortable about it. Now, fortunately, it has not yet resulted in benefits being cut, but that's obviously the next step. If you think you're going to get nothing, then getting half of what you're supposed to get sounds pretty good to you. So that's what the agenda is, what the strategy is going forward. And the people behind it are, a small group of extremely wealthy people. We have one person, the Koch brothers have been involved on this side of the fight and so forth. But there's one man not well known named Pete Peterson,
yes,
who made his money as a hedge fund manager and is a multi-billionaire and has literally placed pledged $1 billion to this campaign. He's probably spent several hundred million at this point, to undermining confidence in Social Security, all in the name of the deficit and saving the future generations and so forth, although what really happens is their benefits will be cut. And they're allied, these ideological opponents are allied with Wall Street. Wall Street sees Social Security currently has a surplus of $2.8 trillion. It's got hundreds of billions of dollars that flow through it. As I said, very little is taken out for administrative costs. It almost all goes for benefits. And of course, financial managers would love to get just a tiny percentage of that amount. And so you've got those kinds of forces. And unfortunately, they have access to the media, which is why I'm so grateful for this interview and why we wrote our book, because we are trying to get, it's truth to power. We're trying to get the truth out.
So the real agenda is they want a piece of the action. They don't want to miss out on all this money that they're not getting. Oh, my goodness. The greed is...
Two things. They want a piece of the action. It's a huge amount of money.
Right.
And they want a piece of it, which they get zero of it now, other than the benefits right. they themselves earn, which is fine. And then they are allied with very wealthy people, and some of them are not just allied. They are one and the same people. They want a piece of it, and they have a really outlier view of their beliefs, which are that that at most the government should, all of us together should provide means-tested benefits or something like that, but not this broad-based insurance, which at the time it was enacted, they argued would compete with private insurance, and I don't think it does that. But I think it's that kind of an idea that both ideology combined with self-interest.
Interesting. And some listeners may have heard of an innocuous-sounding group called No Labels. You know, ostensibly, they're trying to get members of Congress to play nice in the sandbox. No labels. Doesn't that sound swell? There are even some Democrats who are on board with this group. They have a very tight relationship with this Pete Peterson and destroying Social Security, do they not? What do you know about No Labels?
Yes. In fact, Pete Peterson has his finger with that much money. He's got lots of... He's contributed to many, 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 many groups. And so sometimes it'll be frustrating. I'll read a newspaper story, and it'll be five different groups quoted, heads of five different groups, and they're all funded by Pete Peterson. So it's really just one message going through. You know, the idea of no labels and third way and all of us bipartisan, all of it sounds great. The beauty of Social Security is that poll after poll reveals that the American people already agree with each other. You've got Tea Partiers who, along with families with union members in the household, don't want to see Social Security cut and would like to see it expanded. You've got people of color. You have women. You have old. You have young. Young people don't think it'll be there for them, but interestingly, they don't want to see it cut because they understand how vital it is for our society. So you've already got about 80% of the country in agreement. The problem is there's a disconnect that these very wealthy people have the ear of our elected officials. I mean, some of it goes to campaign finance and donors. And so they're kind of in a bind because they want they have to get elected. They need our votes, but they don't want to do what the donors want them to do. And this is a situation where we've got to remind, so really what they're looking for, and we're starting to see it now with a new battle over Social Security involving disability insurance, where they're looking for an excuse, they're looking for something, and I can guarantee you they're going to be trying to negotiate this behind closed doors, out of the view of the public, and if it does emerge, no one will know who to blame for it. What our group is trying to do is shine a spotlight on that and remind these elected officials that they work for us. We don't work for them. And they should do our bidding. And fortunately, on Social Security, you can call it no labels because, as I say, or you can call it every label because conservatives,
everybody likes
progressives,
it.
Independents, African Americans, Hispanics, European Americans, women, men, young, old, everybody believes this program is valuable and they want to see it there in the future. They were frightened it won't be there, but it will be. It's a question of political will. And if I can give you just one plug,
sure.
Thank you so much for mentioning our book. Our website, socialsecurityworks.org, is a place that has a lot of information. We are following minute by minute, what is going on the Hill in the corridors of power and trying to shine a spotlight. So it's a source of information for people who want to stay involved.
And I just want to ask one, I don't know if you can answer this quickly. It's going from the defensive to taking the offense, expanding Social Security. How might that work?
Well, expanding Social Security is a solution. And expanding it is even more of a solution to a number of pressing problems. You have these age-old problems of loss of wages in the event of these various events, old age, disability, death, we think sickness, parental leave when a baby is born or adopted, that we should expand and have benefits in all of those ways. And we should also increase the size of the benefits, which are extremely modest.
Very low.
So it's excellent policy. It makes sense. It is a solution to this income inequality. Back in the 1920s, when we had enormous inequality, we instituted a minimum wage and enacted Social Security. Now that we have it again, we should be raising the minimum wage and expanding Social Security.
Sounds good.
Social Security is a solution. It works.
What's that website again?
Just like the name of the book, socialsecurityworks.org. Without the exclamation point, though.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Very informative. And it's good to know that Social Security is secure. Thanks.
And thank you for having me.
And here is a brand new song by Robin Trower called Gold to Gray. Made me think of Social Security. Thanks very much for listening. Email me, bert@bertcohen.com.
Heartache knows no season. You don't choose when it comes to stay. Girl, give me the rhyme, the reason why she had to leave that way. Well, the sun is darkened down, down from gold, gold to gray. Did not pick up the warning. So many tears I could not explain. Only now the truth is dawning. She was mine only in name. Now the sun has darkened down, down from gold, gold to gray. Down from gold, gold to gray.